Hey, folks, there's no funnier night on TV than Fox Sunday's Animation Domination. And Sunday, an outrageous new family joins the night. Welcome to Duncanville. From executive producer Amy Poehler and producers of The Simpsons comes Duncan, a very average 15-year-old boy with a very vivid imagination. Featuring the voices of Amy Poehler, Ty Burrell, Rashida Jones, and Wiz Khalifa. Duncanville, Sunday nights right after The Simpsons on Fox. Okay?
Lock the gate!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fucking ears? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is the podcast. WTF, welcome to it. I'm the host. It's my show. Broadcasting from my new studio next to my house. In my garage. Nicer garage than the old garage. For those of you who've been around a bit, I've got the panels up. They're got panels bolted into the ceiling. It was very hard. It was hard to let the drills enter the drywall. You know? I mean, you get this. I put a lot of money into this joint in the sense that I had no choice but to make it an apartment. So if somebody needed to live in my studio, they could. But I was wary. I thought maybe we could just Velcro the shit up top, the panels. But I got my guy Julian. He made the smaller boxes. It's cozy in here. The sound is good. I'm thrilled to be out here. It's nice. It's exactly what I wanted it to be when I conceived of it, when I bought this house, before I had to build another house next to it within the garage that was a garage. Had to build a house. Fuck, man. Tomorrow night, folks, Friday, I'm in Orlando, Florida at Hard Rock Live. Then Tampa, Florida on Saturday at the Straz Center. Then the final four dates, Portland, Maine at the State Theater on February 20th. That's a Thursday. Providence, Rhode Island at Columbus Theater Friday, February 21st. New Haven, Connecticut at College Street Music Hall Saturday, February 22nd. And Huntington, New York at the Paramount Sunday, February 23rd. You can go to WTFpod.com/tour for links to all the venues. Today on the show, I talked to a kid named Brett Smurs. Pretty sure that's how you say it. Smurs. Now, look, he's a stunt driver primarily, a stunt person. He's also a one-legged guy. Lost a leg in a oddly, not a stunt accident, but we'll get into that. And the reason I'm having him on is that my interest was spurred by Shauna Duggins, who is the stunt coordinator for GLOW, told me about this mythic family, the Smurs family. They're like stunt royalty. And we reached out to Brett. He's the guy named after his uncle, who I believe was killed during a stunt. But it's just we're dealing a little bit occasionally when we can with these people that are behind the scenes that do other type of work than act or direct or be funny or write. Men and women putting their lives on the line for that drive in Fast and Furious 5 to look authentic. They're putting their life on the line for Jason Statham to look good. Who, by the way, I saw at the Vanity Fair party. I did. I will tell you more about that momentarily. And I do want to say that I thought all the Oscars were solid. I enjoyed the show. There were some funny bits in there. I thought Maya Rudolph and Kristen Wiig were genius. Very good. I mean, you got to look at that, the ceremony with a grain of salt. It is what it is. But I thought most of the awards were right on the money. And I thought the show itself was fine. Some of you may not know, I enjoy watching the Oscars. I love the folly of it. I like looking at the celebrities. I never thought I'd be friends with them, though. I never thought I'd be going to the Vanity Fair party in my life. Then I look at them and I talk to them right to their face. I talk to them in here, too. But I still like watching it on TV. I like seeing how people dress. I guess that's my guilty pleasure. My soft spot. It just is. Folks, your local police department probably receives 100 calls a night from burglar alarms, and they usually have no idea whether the alarm is real. All the alarm company can tell them is the motion sensor went off. SimpliSafe Home Security is different. You get comprehensive protection for your home. SimpliSafe uses real video evidence to give police an eyewitness account of any break-ins. They can tell them where the intruder is in the home, whether they are armed, and what they are doing. Police will dispatch up to 350% faster than for a normal burglar alarm. Outdoor cameras and doorbells alert you to anyone approaching your home. You've got entry, motion, and glass break sensors inside, plus SimpliSafe protects your home from fires, water damage, and carbon monoxide poisoning. And it's all monitored 24/7 by live security professionals. You can set it up yourself with no tools needed, or they can do it for you. And it's only 50 cents a day with no contracts. Go to simplisafe.com/WTF today and get a free SimpliSafe security camera. That's normally $100. But go today and it's free. It will help you capture crucial evidence for the police and a 350% faster dispatch. Go to simplisafe.com/WTF. So, yes, I decided to go to the party, even though, oh, man, I think when I you know what, my new suit, some of you have been through this with me before, and I'm just going to be, you know, transparent about this stuff. This isn't like I'm not star fucking and I'm also not name dropping. This is just the life I'm living right now. And believe me, I did not think I would be living this life. That I will tell you. Now, many of you know I have one black suit that I spent a lot of money on, and I've only worn it maybe not even a dozen times. And I noticed my Tom Ford suit has a little hole in it. And I investigated. I looked closely at it. I had a little smudge on it. It looked like a burn hole. And I think, you know, I don't want to point fingers, but like it's a little burn hole and it's noticeable, and that suit was a fucking fortune. So now I got to figure out what to do. I haven't even taken it to the cleaners yet. I cannot have nice shit. Anything I have that's nice, a guitar, I'll fuck it up. I'll scratch it up within days. A car, I'll fucking wreck it within weeks of having it. Shoes, fuck them up. Pants, whatever. This suit cost a fucking fortune. I thought I would have it for life. I could wear it forever for any occasion instead of a tux or any fancy thing. And now it's got this miniature burn hole in it. And I'm pretty fucking sure Joaquin Phoenix burnt it when I was at the premiere of The Joker. He was smoking, and he hit me with that cigarette, and he fucking burned a hole in my Tom Ford suit. Now, I know he only wore one suit for the entire award season, and I'll tell him right now, I only own one suit, and it's an expensive suit, and I'm pretty sure he burnt a hole in it. So I'm not saying he owes me, but it's just a little hole. It's like an ash hole, but I'm pretty sure it's his hole, and I'm just putting that out there. Now, my one suit, not wearing one suit, my one suit is fucked up because of his bad habit. I'm pretty sure. I was trying to think who else I've been around smoking. I'm pretty sure before we went on the red carpet or right around that area, he was fucking, you know, smoking one. And that's all I'm saying. I'm not looking for money. I'm not looking for a handout. Though I do need to get that fucking thing fixed. And apparently there are weavers that can do that kind of work. Now I get to learn about that, about the meticulous micro weavers. That's what I get to learn about. So very happy about all the awards. I told you that. And I went to the Vanity Fair party and it was pretty exciting. I was kind of like, as many of you heard, I was not feeling great after the Indie Spirit Awards, whatever. But then I go to this party and I didn't go last year because I thought like I had nothing to do with the Oscars. But it turns out no one at the fucking party even went to the Oscars except for the people that were on the Oscars for the most part. Everyone else is just invited. I saw a bunch of fucking people I knew there, a bunch of friends there, a bunch of celebrities. And a lot of this, the big stars came later. We went over there like 9:30, 10 o'clock. We were there for like an hour and a half, which was enough. I met Kerry Washington. Because Lynn just worked with her on a Little Fires Everywhere. I rubbed up against, not in a weird way, but just trying to get by Marty Scorsese. But I did not talk to him because he was talking to Patty Clarkson, who said hi to me after Martin Scorsese walked away. She's been on the show. I met Will McCormack, who's an actor and a TV producer that Lynn's working with. Michael Keaton and I chatted a bit about the movie that he's in. That I have one line in barely, but we talked a lot about that and about his appearance on WTF with Judd Apatow, who was standing there. Dave Spade was there, but I see him all the time at the Comedy Store. Maxine Waters, Congresswoman Maxine Waters, was there, and I said, thank you. Thank you for your service, Congresswoman. She goes, we're going to keep doing it. We're going to keep giving it to him, sticking it to him. Whitney Cummings, who I did not recognize because she was so stunning that night, was there. Ray Romano, of course, the funny man and turned actor, very good actor. Pete Berg, the director of Spencer Confidential, which is a movie, and the creator of Friday Night Lights. But more recently, Spencer Confidential, which I'm in, and it looks like I made the cut on that. I'll also be talking to Pete on the show here. Daniel Levy. Now, as you know, I spoke to Dan Levy, who is not Daniel Levy from Schitt's Creek. Dan Levy is a comedian and showrunner of Indebted. Daniel Levy, Eugene Levy's son, and Schitt's Creek creator. I talked to him. I said, come on the show. We got to even it up. I need to end the confusion. Lin-Manuel Miranda. Lin-Manuel Miranda. Yeah. Talked to him. Mark Maron fan. We go back. Hamilton, lovely man. We chatted. This is at the Vanity Fair party. This is what was going on. This is a community shindig, man. Taika Waititi said, Maron, and I walked by him. Utkarsh Ambudkar is a big fan of the show. I enjoyed his work in Brittany Runs a Marathon, and I'm going to have him on this show. Nick Kroll saw him. His girlfriend, Lily Kwong, I met her for the first time, who claims the show helped her out a lot, which I'm happy that that happened. Ray Sehorn, who I love, who I should probably have on the show. Ronan Farrow, I met and talked to a bit. He's going to be on the show soon. John Lovett, who I've done shows with him. He was with Ronan Farrow and is with Ronan Farrow. Joni Mitchell was there, did not talk to her. She was just sitting there, and no one seemed to bother her. Sarah Silverman, of course. Bill Maher, I tried to communicate with for a moment. Very difficult. You're dealing with a fairly weighty curtain of weed between, you know, his face and his brain. But he locked in. He remembered me. He knows I did his show. And then he wondered if I had worked together with him on the road. I have not. James Corden, very pleasant. Love him. Was there. Patton Oswalt and his wife, Meredith, very pleasant. Joanna Newsom and Andy Samberg, both been on this show. Not really talking to me much. Friends of my ex-girlfriend. Bob Odenkirk, always there to be parental. So what have you got going on now? What are you working on? Odenkirk, Connie Britton, Keegan-Michael Key and his wife, they were talking to her, and I get it. Yep. Tony Hale, great. That was the best moment, Tony Hale. And I'll explain that to you in a minute. Someone that we talked to is not on this list. Now I'm trying to remember who. Elizabeth Banks. Yeah. It was an amazing night. Oh, and Griffin Dunn was running around. A lot of past guests, friends, new people to meet, people I asked to be on the show. And, Jason Statham. I watched at this party, they have people, women from In-N-Out Burger, dispatched from In-N-Out Burger, walking around with fucking full cheeseburgers, whole cheeseburgers, just walking around with trays of In-N-Out cheeseburgers. I fucking inhaled one. And then we were out back. I was outside. I was getting ready to leave. And I watched Jason Statham just eat a cheeseburger. Should have recorded it. He didn't do it quickly. It was not complicated. It was not menacing. There didn't seem to be any real sort of... It was not exciting. But I saw it. I watched it. I watched the whole thing. So maybe it was compelling. I watched him eat the whole cheeseburger. He didn't notice me. But I was watching. So as I was waiting to leave, we were on our way out. Brad Pitt and his crew come walking out. His mom, I believe, is with him and some other people. And they're walking out. We're about to leave. We're waiting to get the car. And Brad Pitt comes bounding out. And I look at him like, Brad! He's like, Maron! And I said, congratulations, man. That was great. I'm proud of you, buddy. Good job. He said, thanks, pal. And then a Vanity Fair photographer comes running up picture, and I'm like, hell yeah. And Brad was like, yep, we took the picture, and he just ran off, and they had his escalator, big limo, was right there, right down the stairs. Mine, we had to walk over a thing and under a thing and across the way, and that's where we saw Tony Hale, who I think we saw him. I'm like, what's up? He's like, I'm leaving. And he's like, I just got here. I can't do it. So I think Tony was there for like 3 seconds and just was leaving. I thought that was very, very Tony Hale of him. So that was that evening. Great evening. Had In-N-Out Burger. Had some fancy pizza there. Had a bit of a fancy corn dog thing. Some bad desserts. But these are all bite-sized things. But the In-N-Out cheeseburger, to be honest, really the best moment of the night. Even after meeting and hanging out and talking to all those lovely people, I met Joel Silver, the big producer guy from way back in the day. And he was brash. I had a realization about that, though. He was talking to Whitney Cummings, and I'm like, I thought the show was good. He's like, no, I thought it was fucking terrible. I'm like, really? He's like, yeah. I'm like, there were some funny bits. He's like, whatever. I'm like, well, when was the last good one in your mind? It's like, good question. I don't know. And then I realized, like, these guys who were a little older than me, or 10 years older than me, 20 years older than me, the boomers, the real boomers, you know, it's like, it's not for them anymore. Their generation is gone. There's no Jack Nicholson sitting up front. There's not that whole generation. They're not even there anymore, hardly any of them. I remember them from when I was a kid. That was something you look forward to, but there's a whole new bunch of people now. You know? And it's like their judgment weighs so heavy, that generation, because they still dictate a lot of culture and they still refuse to go away. And I know I'm the tail end of it, but I'm exiting. I'll be gone. I know when I've overstayed my welcome. But the point is, it's like my mother's boyfriend. It's always just sort of like, it was a different time. It was a different time. Yeah, it's over. That time is done, like any other time for any other generation of old fucks. It passes, and you just got to suck it up, man. Instead of raining on the goddamn parade for every other generation. But yeah, it was a different time. Exactly. It's over. And this is the new time. Adapt or die. Right? Dig it. Yeah? Okay. Where are we at now? If you purchase supplies for a small to mid-sized business, Zorro.com, that's Z-O-R-O.com, is your go-to resource. At Zorro, you'll find all the things that keep a business running, no matter what kind of business you're in. Zorro offers tools, safety equipment, cleaning and maintenance supplies, office and shipping, automotive, industrial equipment, and more, including the specialty items you can't find anywhere else. Whether you're shopping for an office, factory, a contracting business, or a machine shop, you can get exactly what you need. And when you shop at Zorro, you'll find brands you already know and trust, like 3M, Prestone, Stanley Black & Decker, Schneider Electric, and Rubbermaid, all at competitive prices. Want fast, free shipping? It's yours when you spend $50 or more. And if you have a question, a return, or you need help finding exactly the right item, count on Zorro's customer service team based right here in the U.S. Visit Zorro.com/WTF and sign up for Zmail to get 15% off your first order. That's Zorro.com/WTF and sign up for Zmail for 15% off. Zorro.com, all you need to make your business go. So this guy that I talked to right now, Brett Smurfs, has been doing stunts in dozens of movies and TV shows over the past decade. A lot of Marvel movies. He's Paul Rudd's double in Ant-Man. He was a stunt driver for Ford versus Ferrari. When we talked, the Michael Bay film Six Underground had just come out. Brett did some pretty spectacular driving stunts in that film, and you can check it out on Netflix if you want to see what this guy does. It's crazy. This is me talking to Brett Smurfs. So I just watched the beginning of Six Underground. Now, you're driving that car.
Yes.
The green car.
The green Alpha. Mm-hmm.
And that's really Florence, Italy.
Yep, it was. All the streets of Italy. Florence, Italy was most of it. They went to Siena and they went a few other places, but all the driving scenes that I did was in Florence.
Now, I don't make movies like that. I don't really act in movies like that. And it seems to be completely, the entire pace of the film is driven by stunts and driven by the driving. So it has to look pretty real. And but they could just do it another way, couldn't they?
Yeah, of course. I mean, there's always ways around it, make it look fake and stuff. Yeah. But most of the stuff that we did was practical. I mean, there was some CG
practical
spots,
meaning
but...
that you're hands-on, like real.
Yes, real.
That's what practical means.
Exactly. Yeah. So there was a few shots that they added, you know, some CGI, but not many. Most of that stuff was all real, and we did it all for real and practical. And
well, I mean, when you're driving through, which museum was it?
Well, we did the Uffizi Museum. That was pretty crazy.
But you did that. But when you go into that thing, it's not the real museum, is it?
So here's the thing. So we broke into the door, and there was a museum, and it wasn't when we broke through the door. It wasn't the Uffizi specifically,
right?
But we did drive around the Uffizi, and we did go through a museum. When I came through that door, it was all real. There was a real statue, and I had to avoid it. And if I didn't, we were in big trouble.
Right, yeah.
And it was very tight spot.
Like
so
it was like a real historical statue?
It was. I can't remember exactly which museum that was for that shot, but it was very old, and they made very, very sure that we were not going to hit that
But
thing.
It seems like that's, like most of Italy is like that.
Yes.
That in terms of, like, destroying historical artifacts, the possibilities were endless.
Yes. I drove a few other cars other than the green car. There was a crash sequence in the very beginning, and I did a flip. I was crashing the car, and they didn't want us to touch the grass, and unfortunately, it didn't all go to plan, and we went over the grass, and that was a big...
The grass was a big deal?
The grass was a big deal. So, like you said, everything in Italy is very historical. They love everything. They don't want anything ruined. So
right.
It was very much like we had to take care of everything.
But that's such a gamble. It's such a risk. So you're working, like, Michael Bay's directing the thing. Is he out of his mind?
No, I really like Michael.
I don't know anything about him, but like it's just like I just see the hierarchy. Like there's a guy at the top who is him, who's used to doing these type of movies, and then it just sort of goes down from there. And he's saying like, I need this car to spin and these guys to fly into a van, and I need blood and everything else. And then there's a whole army of people under him that make that happen.
Absolutely. So he the way he operates is he'll go on set. He knows exactly what he wants. He'll think about what he wants. And then he'll go on set and he'll tell everyone, hey, this is what I want. And if people don't listen and they don't do what they're supposed to, or they're not paying attention, that's when he'll get into his mode and he'll get really serious. But otherwise, if you're doing your job and you're paying attention, you do what he wants, then he's really like, he's a good guy. He's a good person to work for. And I enjoyed it, honestly. He was very serious.
You sort of have to be. You have to feel safe. Like, I've only talked to one other stunt person. I talked to Sean and Duggins.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Who is the coordinator for GLOW, which I'm on. And, you know, I talked to her, you know, how she came into stunt work and just, you know, the care that has to have anything. You have to trust the situation. You have to make sure the situation is sound, right?
Absolutely.
Before you go into something. But like with her, she just found out that she didn't plan to be a stunt person for her whole life. She wanted to be an actress, and she came into these. She had a certain skill set, and she met a certain bunch of people, and she ended up in it. But you're like, your whole family's in it.
That's right. Yeah, my dad, my uncle.
Now, your dad is Brian or Brett?
My dad is Greg Smurfs.
Greg Smurfs?
Mm-hmm.
And your uncle was Brett?
So I have my uncle Brian Smurfs, and he had a twin brother, and his name was Brett Smurfs, who I was named after. So
right.
He had an accident in, I think, 1987 or 1988.
It's very hard to find your IMDb among all the other Smurfs.
Yes, it was, and there's also his, Brett Smurfs' IMDb is also still there, so some people get it mixed up.
Right. I genuinely, I couldn't find yours. Is that possible?
That's terrible. I need to work on that.
Well, I mean, didn't seem to be enough options. So, okay, so your dad is a big stunt guy. Like, he's like one of the main stunt guys.
He is. He's up there. I mean, he's done a lot of stuff. He's worked with, you know, Tom Cruise a lot. He's done a lot of
Mission Impossible. Didn't he climb that building in Dubai?
He did, yes.
What's that building called?
It's called the Burj Khalifa. I went up there with him. We got to sit up on top of it, and that was a pretty wild experience.
Oh, my God. Sit up there?
I got to sit up there.
With a rope?
No. We were tied in. We had a little harness on our waist, but we were going up there to scout it and make sure it was safe. Tom Cruise was going up there to do a photo shoot for, I think it was Time Magazine.
Yeah.
So we went up there and just scouted it, make sure it was okay, and it was a wild experience. I mean, it was half a mile in the air just sitting up there, and you look down, and it's, like, insane.
I'm getting freaked out just hearing about it. I mean, but no fear?
I had, you know what, I'm not the greatest with heights, but I got over it after about 10 minutes. Like, sitting up there for 10 minutes. The thing that was really tripping me out was that it sways left and right because it's so windy and so skinny and it's high up in the air. So it moves like 10 feet back and forth.
Oh,
so that was
God.
Really what was tripping me out. But
and your dad, well, your dad's name is, what is your dad's name?
It's Greg Smurfs.
Greg.
With two G's, and don't forget the second G.
Right. Or there's going to be trouble?
There will be trouble.
Now, like, okay, so you grow up in this, but was your grandfather in show business?
No, so my grandmother was an actress and a model, so she was in that kind of industry, and then my dad and his brothers wanted to do stunts, so they moved to New York, and they started off in New York.
They grew up here?
They grew up in Philadelphia.
Oh, in Philly.
Mm-hmm. So they were East Coast boys, and then they moved to New York, started off there, and then they realized that Los Angeles was like the spot back then in the 80s when they, or the 70s when they started.
Yeah.
L.A. was the spot to be, so they all moved.
So they, do you know how they got started in stunts? I mean, do you know the story? I mean, outside, so they're in New York, they're in the film, probably the TV industry, or maybe they're doing shit for like some of the 70s movies that were being shot there. Is that how it worked?
Yeah, I mean, so I think what they ended up doing is they went out there, they bought a bunch of like equipment, and they learned how to do rigging and fire safety and just all this stuff, and then they would go out and they on their own, yep. Yeah. I mean, they would meet other stunt people and they'd learn things and then kind of practice on their own. So they'd go out and they'd go meet stunt coordinators and show them like, hey, this is what I can do. And eventually, back then the business was really super, like super tight.
Yeah.
Like it was hard to break into. So, but the three of them together kind of they helped each other. And you know, it was a lot of work back then to get into the stunt business. You had to be like very talented, very well rounded. You had to do everything.
Really?
And like, nowadays,
well,
it's
you
almost,
mean like you had to be able to, you know, drive a car like. You have to be able to roll a car and ride a horse kind of deal.
Exactly. Yeah.
Right.
It was well rounded. So
right.
They would do fire burns, high falls, car hits, motorcycle jumps, car crashes, anything you can think of. They were crazy.
Right.
I could never do all that stuff.
No.
They're wild.
But when you're growing up in that though, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So like your dad's friends, cause I read this book, about Sam Peckinpah and about that crew. There used to just be, and also, yeah, did you see Once Upon a Time in Hollywood?
I have not seen that yet, no.
Well, you know, Brad Pitt plays a stunt guy, but I just got the feeling that back in the 70s and even the 50s and 60s, that the stunt guys were kind of the yahoos, like the test pilots and the right stuff, just these crazy dudes that used to drink hard and hang out with each other and kind of live on the edge. And I guess by the time your dad was getting into it, they were probably a little more responsible.
A little bit, yeah. I think it was still a lot looser than it is now.
Yeah.
Back in the 50s, I'd say they got away with anything.
Like, right.
It was anything goes. And then when my dad broke in, there was still a lot of really loose rules. They could get away with a lot of things. Now it's very, very, like, you can't really get away with anything these days. Like, everything's recorded. You can't, you know. So, like, we're all, you know. It's
recorded, what do you mean?
Well, just everything's, you know, it's all, you know.
Oh, there's only one, you know, they're recording every take, you mean? Like back
then? Everyone's got a cell phone, so everything can go on, you know.
Right, right.
But people used to, like, go up in airplanes. If they're going to jump out of with a parachute, they'd, like, take some cocaine and jump out. Like, it was wild back then. There was no rules. So,
no
and
more.
Obviously I don't do any of that stuff, you know. But
no more pre-jump bumps?
No, yeah, no. Definitely not.
But, all right, so when do you start being cognizant of your dad's job? What's your mom do? Is she in the business?
No, so my mom was a secretary,
yeah.
And that's how they met. She was a secretary, and she worked at a motorcycle shop. My dad used to race motorcycles, and that's how they met. And then,
so he was a motorcycle racer as a hobby.
Yeah, well, he used to do it professionally. He used to race against like Wayne Rainey and all those guys. He raced. It was called Formula One AMA racing
back
in the 70s.
Yeah,
so he was trying to do that professionally.
Before the stunting?
Yes. So he was doing racing and stunts at the same time.
Yeah.
And when he came to the point where he had to make a decision,
it was
kind of taking over each other. So he had to quit racing and do
was
stunts.
Was he making money racing?
No.
He wasn't.
But he was very fast. So as from what I heard, he was very quick.
Does he still ride?
He does. He actually works on the show Ride with Norman Reedus. So he does all those, and he still rides all the time. He's a big cross country rider, and he doesn't do like any track day stuff anymore, I think he's still got it. When I follow him in the canyons, he's pretty quick.
Yeah. You ride too?
I do. Yeah.
What kind of bike you got?
I have a GS 700 BMW.
Yeah. Nice. You're not a Harley guy?
I like Harleys. I just never owned one. I'm sure if I rode one, I would really like it.
But big bikes. You're not out in the dirt. You're a street bike guy.
Yeah, I mean, I've never done any dirt experience. Like, I'm all like canyons. Just go out, have fun, and
on the street.
Exactly. Yeah.
Not jumping over things.
I'd love to go do a track day or something. That would be cool.
Which
too.
Is what?
Like go out to a racetrack and take a bike out. And
but you're
go
not going
to
go fly over mountains and stuff.
No. I mean, I would go have fun with it, but there's a stunt race called the Hooper Classic. Like that's coming up next month.
Yeah.
I won't enter that because I'll probably go out there and kill myself.
Right.
You know?
So you don't do any motorcycle stunts?
Not really, no. No, I'll leave that. So that's the thing. That's what I was getting at. It's like now the stunt world is kind of, you have like your talent. Yeah. There's some guys that are very well-rounded and they can do anything. But there's, like, say you need a motorcycle sequence. They'll purposely seek out, like, who's the best motorcycle rider.
Oh, right,
and
sure.
they'll pick them.
So oh, I see, right.
I don't want anything to do with it. It's like, dude, you can
You're
hire
a driver?
Him. I'm a driver. I do all driving, all car stuff.
That's no jumping. No flying off of buildings.
No, not in my body. I'll jump off a building in a car, no problem. But but not me personally.
But your dad'll jump off buildings.
Yeah, yeah, he would. I don't know if he would anymore. He's directing and moving on in the world. So
oh, really?
Yeah.
He's out of he's not doing any more death-defying stunts.
He'll do some stuff. Like he'll do driving. He'll crash a car. Or he'll light up on fire and get fully lit. You know, stuff like that. But it's not as crazy as it looks. Like when you see someone fully lit, they got three layers of fire protective gear.
Sure.
They got gel. So it's it looks scary, but it's pretty safe. You know, we try and keep everything as safe as possible.
You still got to do it.
Yeah, exactly. It's still in your brain.
So do you have brothers and sisters?
I have a sister.
Mm-hmm. Is she in the racket too?
No, she is. She lives in Texas.
Yeah.
She's married. She's got three kids.
Oh,
and
no stunt. No
stunts. Nope. She kind of had the bug for a little bit, but then
oh, really?
She really wanted to be like a stay at home mom and all that stuff. And,
right.
Her husband's in the military and he travels a lot.
Okay.
So
regular life ish.
Yep.
All right. So now you're growing up. When do you first start to realize that this is what your dad does? Does he ever? Was there any like growing up in a stunt family? Was there any like did your uncle or anybody come to your birthday parties with flaming suits? Was there any sort of?
I wish. That would have been awesome.
Any stunts at home? But I mean, when do you start realizing this is the gig?
So I started racing when I was 12 years old, and I was racing go-karts and open-wheel cars. And what I really wanted to do. I wanted to be a professional race car driver.
Oh,
and that's
really?
What I was pursuing, and I was doing that until
at 12.
I was... Yes. I was racing go-karts like nationally against people that were from
Columbia. So you had one of those
Columbia
fancy go-karts.
Yeah.
Real fast ones.
Yep. It was the pro circuit in the U.S.
How fast did they go, those go-karts?
Those carts would go 100 miles an hour, and they were about an inch off the ground, so it felt like you're going way faster.
That's crazy, man.
Yeah, they were moving. They were definitely not slow.
So this was just something you wanted to do? You just were you just had it in your blood to kind of go fast and do dangerous shit?
Well, so my dad bought me a cart for Christmas.
Oh, well,
and then he had the bug brought back to him because he quit motorcycle racing. And then when he bought the go-kart, he was like, oh, man, let's go racing. And then once we started, I was like, we're not stopping. This is way too much fun. So,
but did you go to sets with him and stuff? Were you like, did you like experience that stuff as a young person?
I did. Yeah. Like I'd go to a few. Like my dad was always traveling when I was a kid. So he was gone probably 10
on
months
shoots.
Out of the year. He would, he'd be on a movie for a long shot. So,
yeah.
We'd go out and travel with him. So I went to like Vancouver, Canada when he was working on Paycheck. I went to Australia when he was working on Mission Impossible 2. Like,
so did he do all those Mission Impossibles?
He did. Let's see. He did the second one.
Yeah.
He did Ghost Protocol and he did Rogue Nation.
Yeah. Wow. I'm just looking at his credits right now. I'm going to find yours in a minute.
Yeah, he's got some pretty serious credits. He's been around for a while. And him and my uncle, between the two of them, they've got a pretty good
resume. They were the guys.
Yeah, they're pretty up there. And they do second unit directing now. And I think they're both trying to break into the actual first unit directing realm. And they've gotten a few.
First unit is like right under the director?
No,
that is the director.
That is the director.
The guy
so,
who directs the movie.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So Brian has directed a few movies. He did one with Cuba Gooding. I think it was called Shadow Boxer.
Uh-huh.
So he did that one. He's done a few others. He's still trying to break into it and get more of that. But I think for the most part, they're doing second unit directing. And I honestly think that's pretty cool. Like
that's
all the stunts and it's like the fun unit. So
I mean, it makes sense after a certain point to graduate to something.
Right. Absolutely.
You know, like you're going to age out of throwing yourself off buildings and driving cars into walls, right?
Right. Absolutely.
So what, when you were younger, was there a point where you saw your dad do something, either or was told that he did it and you were watching it where you're like, holy shit, that's what I want to do, or that's my dad, or like, do you have a recollection of that?
No, I don't. So it's kind of funny. My dad's very humble and he's very quiet and he doesn't really boast about stuff that he's done. So yeah. I don't even know a lot of the stuff he's done. Like, I've seen photos of,
really?
Things, but there was photos that I saw and I was like, damn, that's really cool. Like he has a photo of him on a motorcycle jumping out of a subway and he's like 5 feet in the air.
Yeah.
Sick.
Yeah.
Such a cool photo.
Right.
So that kind of stuff made me want to get into it, but I really wanted the race, and I didn't really think about doing stunts at all until racing was not an option anymore.
What happened?
Well, it just got too expensive. It's such an expensive sport.
Go-kart racing?
Well, go-kart racing in general, it's expensive, but yeah. I was moving on to open-wheel cars, and I was going up the ladder.
Open-wheel cars, what's that?
So do you know what like an Indy car or a Formula One car is?
Sure, yeah.
It was like that, but way slower. Like, they would go 140, 150, and like not
and
top
what,
speed slower.
15 or 16? How old are you when you're doing that?
I was 14, 15. And
those are real cars.
They are,
yeah. Okay.
So we moved to Idaho, and in Idaho, you can get your driver's license at 14.
Right.
And you can't drive anyone in the car, but you can legally have your driver's license, and that was all it took, and I could just go race. Now I have a driver's license, and I can race anything. So
right.
That was kind of a bonus to living up in Idaho.
How long did you live in Idaho?
5 years.
Why did you go to Idaho?
My parents moved there for like real estate purposes. They wanted to invest in real estate, and it didn't end up working out. But we stayed there for 5 years and then moved back to California.
And you got your driver's license.
Yeah, and I have my driver's license.
So you're driving race cars at 15.
Yep.
And it became too expensive because you have to buy a race car?
No, you don't. You can rent the car and you can go through a team and they'll prep it and bring it to the track and everything. It's honestly better that way. It's a lot of work to buy the car yourself and have to prep it. And unless you know what you're doing, then it's a lot of work.
Right.
I'll put it this way. If you were racing Formula Fords for one season, it would cost about $150,000. That's grassroots. That's as low as it gets.
Wow.
Then you move up to Formula Ford 2000s and it goes up to $250,000. Then you go up to Indy Lights and it's now jumped to $1 million.
Right.
Like it's the price range just jumps drastically. So once you get to a certain spot, you could keep racing that, but it's not going to get you anywhere.
Right.
And you could get your name out there kind of, but you really have to move and have the money to move up the ladder. Otherwise, it's not going to work out.
Huh.
So, and especially with open wheel, it's a young man's game.
Yeah.
So right now I'm 28.
You're
That's
out?
Way too late.
Really?
For open wheel. I mean, I could jump into it, but I would have to go up the ladder slowly again.
Right.
And it would take 4 years, and I'd be 32 by the time I got to IndyCar. So it's a tough business. And the sports car world is very open. I mean, you can race that until you're 60, 70 years old.
Oh, that's good.
And there are guys out there doing it.
So you get out of the racing racket and you're 14.
I was actually 18. So I continued that until I was 18 years old.
Now, your uncle passed away before you were born?
Yes, I never met him.
You just heard about it.
I heard about it.
What was the stunt that did it?
So remember I said they moved to L.A., they were practicing stunts, trying to get their resumes up and stuff. So they used to just go out and practice things. So they took an airbag and they went down to Los Angeles and they were practicing high falls. And
where? Los Angeles?
In Los Angeles, on 6th Street or whatever, one of those main streets.
Yeah.
And they set the airbag up and they climbed the fire escape and got up on top of the building, and they both, Brian and Brett, did a jump. And I think it was just... He went off backwards and just miscalculated and just missed. He missed the airbag and he ended up dying. And I wasn't born yet, so my parents decided to name me after him. And so I'm continuing his legacy.
So you were sort of destined.
Yes.
Now,
yeah.
When did you actively start trying to do stunts, though?
At 18. So 18 years old, I realized that racing was it was going to be very difficult to continue on.
Yeah.
My parents were helping me fund it until I was 18, and when I turned 18, they dropped it, and I was on my own trying to find sponsors and everything, and it's really, really tough, especially with the racing that is not televised,
right.
So there's you can't really get their name out without people being there watching, and there's not a lot of spectators.
Now, were you winning?
Yeah, I was. I was winning a lot. I actually, when I quit, I won this scholarship called the Team USA Scholarship, and that was the most prestigious open wheel prize that a young person could win.
Right.
So I did that, and I raced in England, and I did this race called the Formula Ford Festival, which is one of the biggest races that they have in England.
Yeah.
A lot of famous racers, Formula One drivers, have raced that and done well. And I had a horrible, heat races and stuff. So I started the main event in last place, in 28th, I think.
Right.
And I ended up getting third. So yeah. I came all the way through the field and got third, and that was one of the best races of my career.
Yeah.
And then I ran out of funds. And that was pretty much
that was the end. Okay, so how do you decide to get – what happened to your leg?
What happened? I don't know. It's gone. I don't know where it went. Someone took it and stole it.
Because it seems like, you know, we're talking about racing and stuff, but at some point there's a story where you lost your leg.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And it clearly wasn't stunts.
There was a lot of stories that went around. A lot of people made rumors of how I lost it. No one actually.
Like what?
Of how it happened in a car accident.
Oh, really?
It didn't. No, I was
a stunt guy.
Yeah.
So you figure like he must've lost doing a stunt.
So when I was younger, I did gymnastics from like 3 years old to 13. I was very into gymnastics. And I loved it.
I think Shauna was into that too.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
Shauna's really talented. Yeah, she is an extremely talented woman.
Yeah. And, but like, you know, it seems like gymnastics is sort of a launching pad for the type of disposition that might, you know, lead to stunts.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. No, gymnastics is such great training. It teaches you body positioning and like if you're falling, even if you're not doing anything, you know, gymnastic-y, if you're just taking a fall, it helps because you know where your body is, how to fall properly.
Right.
So it really is a good stepping stone, and I think that's why my parents put me into gymnastics.
So you'd know how to fall correctly,
well,
just in case.
I think my dad really wanted me to do stunts.
He did.
So he was trying to get me, you know,
really
prep me for it.
You never asked him? He never told you?
Not
he never
really,
said
no.
That.
Yeah, I think it was one of those, like, if you want to do it, you got to show me and you got to do it.
All right. So they just want to make sure if you wanted to do it, you had everything in place.
Right.
But he never did gymnastics, your old man, right?
Nope. I don't think he did. Nope.
So, okay, so you're into gymnastics till you're like 13 or 14.
Yep. So I quit gymnastics. I hadn't done it for probably 2 years.
Yeah.
But I was still able to do things, and I still had good body sense, and I could flip on trampolines and stuff. So I was over at my girlfriend's house at the time, and we were in Idaho, and my buddy was like, hey, let's go off the balcony. Let's jump off the balcony to the trampoline.
Yeah.
And it was a pretty big jump. I mean,
this is a regular-sized trampoline.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay.
And it was right under the balcony, and it was probably a 12, 13-foot drop to the trampoline.
Yeah.
So he gets up there, and he climbed up, and you could either stand up on the railing or climb over and then jump off.
Right.
And if you climbed over it, that made like 5 feet less.
Sure, yeah.
So he did that, and he jumped off. And he was all fine and dandy, and I was like, man, I want to do a flip. You know, I've never done that before, I'm doing it.
A flip before or after you hit the trampoline?
So it was before.
Oh.
So I flipped off of the balcony on top of the railing. It was a big jump.
Oh, man.
And I landed it. I landed on my feet, but I was twisting. And when I landed, it just snapped my leg and the rebound just completely jammed it. And it was all mangled. It didn't look bad, but internally it was really screwed.
Oh, my God.
So I ended up cutting the artery. I damaged some nerve, cut the muscle tissue. My tibia got shoved up into my meniscus, my knee, and it was jammed.
Yeah.
All kinds of problems. I had compartment syndrome, which is when blood's coming in, not coming out.
Ugh.
So my leg was just swelling, swelling, swelling. So, and that's why I was like, I got to go to the hospital.
What do you mean? You didn't go to the hospital right after it happened?
No. So I was 16. I was young and dumb, and I had a race coming up in a week. So I didn't want to tell my parents, hey, I just broke my leg being an idiot. You know, they would have killed me.
Right.
And so I was like, man, maybe I just sprained it. I'll just wait it out.
What?
Honestly, I think I was in shock. And I didn't feel any pain at all.
Right.
Until about an hour, and then it started really hurting.
Yeah.
The cut artery does not feel good.
Yeah. Terrible.
I called my mom. She got me to the hospital. I was in the waiting room for probably an hour and a half.
Yeah.
And then when they x-rayed me and realized how bad it was, I went into an immediate surgery. And that led into, I had 9 surgeries in 13 days. To try and save it.
Yeah.
Let's see. The 5th surgery, they ended up taking it off.
Ugh.
But they didn't even realize that I had a cut artery for 3 days. So it wasn't until the 4th surgery that they even tried to save my leg.
Right.
So my leg was already toast by then.
Oh.
You only have 6 hours to save an artery.
Oh, okay.
And it took them 3 days.
Right.
So my leg was completely dead by the time they got to it.
Oh, my God.
They were just cleaning it, fixing the broken bone, and then leaving it at it as is. So it was kind of a mess.
Yeah.
But it ended up working out. I left that place and I went to another hospital, and that guy ended up fixing me, and his name was Dr. Smith.
Fixing you post amputation.
Yes. So when I finished in Idaho with all those surgeries, all those 9 surgeries, it was so mangled still that I couldn't even put a leg on. So I couldn't wear a prosthetic leg.
What part of it was mangled? Beneath the knee or at the knee? Like they couldn't.
Beneath the knee. So yeah. So what ended up happening is on the day of the amputation, my doctor left town.
Yeah.
And he went and did a marathon in California, and he left it to his assistant to do this operation. And he's never met me before, never done an amputation. So I had people operating on me who'd never done an amputation. So my leg, by the time it was over, it was pretty mangled inside. Like it was
the
not
guy, your doctor who was supposed to cut your leg off split
because he had down.
He'd been preparing for a marathon.
Yes.
So he let the doctor on call or the guy who worked with him do it.
Correct.
And he had never done it before.
Correct. It was a mess. Yeah. So when it was all said and done, I got it all casted. It was all finished. They got me casted, and they casted my leg bent, right? So if you cast someone like on the joint, you want to have it straight so that at least for a leg, because if I take the cast off and it's bent, I can't wear a prosthetic leg. If it's permanently bent like that, you can't wear a leg. Uh-huh. But if it's straight, you could at least wear it and hobble along.
Right.
So they casted it bent, and when I took the cast off, my leg was stuck. And I had this guy trying to help me get the range of motion back. But when I got...
Oh, because you still had the knee joint?
I do. I still have my knee. So I was trying to get that range of motion back in my knee. But he spent 3 weeks trying to, and I never got more than like 3 degrees of motion. And he was like, man, this is bad. Like, there's something wrong.
Right.
So I went and got it re-x-rayed, and there was bone fragments from when they took the leg off that floated into my meniscus, and it was jamming. It was like, imagine sticking a bone into like a gear. It was just jamming it.
Yeah.
So I had that, and then my fibula, the bone on the side of your leg, was dislocated. It wasn't even in the socket, so it was just floating in there.
You weren't in pain?
I was. If you touched my leg with the slightest pressure, even like just like the lightest touch, it hurt.
Yeah.
It was bad. So I went to like the best guy in the United States. He fixed me up, and now I'm all good. So
like... At that moment, though, coming from the family you come from and being as athletic as you were, I mean, was there a moment or a week or a year where you were just sort of like, I'm fucked? And
no, to be honest with you, when I was in the hospital, it was really strange, like, events. Like, I read this book called Alex Zanardi is My Sweetest Victory. It's this race car driver named Alex Zanardi, and he lost both of his legs in a racing accident.
So you read this after you lost your leg?
I read it before, like a few months before I lost it. It was very bizarre. Like, someone told me about this book, I read it, and then all of a sudden this happens.
Yeah.
So it was very weird, but it was honestly good that I read it, because that was in my brain that this guy lost his legs, re-came back, and he's killing it now.
Yeah.
So that was one. And then two, I visually remember when I was 9 years old in Vancouver on paycheck, they were also filming Inspector Gadget, I think, at the time.
Your dad's movie, Paycheck?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I might be mixing this up. It might have been Inspector Gadget.
Yeah.
Because when I was there, there was a guy named Casey Peretti, and he has a right leg prosthetic below the knee.
Yeah.
And I still talk with him to this day. He's an awesome guy. Very, very talented stunt guy.
Yeah.
But he was wearing stilts, doubling Inspector Gadget with his prosthetic running down the street. So I visually remember that from when I was young.
Uh-huh.
And I thought that was so cool.
That he could do that.
And I thought his leg was really bitching. I thought it was so cool looking. And then when I'm in the hospital, that's all I was thinking about was how cool his leg was. And I'm like, I'm going to have one of those. So I honestly, it bugged me a little bit, but it was more so my mom that was bugged. Like, it bugged her bad.
She freaked out.
She was freaking out. But it was all good. I told her it's all fine. As long as I can race, I didn't really care. Even if
in
I
the
didn't.
Car.
As long as I could race a car, I didn't care.
Yeah.
So that was all I kept asking the doctors, will I still be able to race? How can I, you know, how will we make this work?
You just weren't going to be able to jump off balconies and do flips anymore.
Right. But I honestly didn't care, because I knew my passion was cars. And as long as I could get back into a car and drive, it didn't bother me. Really.
Yeah.
So,
but are you able to do like physical stuff now? I mean, at this point you are, right?
I can. I choose not to.
Yeah.
I just want to take care of it as long as I can. And I don't want to mess up and break it and then be screwed.
So you were 16 when that happened?
I was.
And then you raced for a couple more years in the cars until you were 18. So you got, which foot is it?
It's my left foot. So it's my clutch foot, which is I'm very thankful for that. It was my left one.
Yeah?
Yes.
You had to figure out how to punch a clutch.
Which, honestly, so usually you use your ankle when you're using a clutch.
Sure. Yeah, you're pushing down.
But now I use my knee, so I just use like a straight leg motion.
Oh, I see.
And
I'll push
the clutch down with a straight leg kind of deal. So I'm very thankful that I have my knee, and I'm very thankful that it's my left leg. If I go above my knee, I'll be in trouble because then I have to move my hip to get. And if you're strapped down in seatbelts in a car, it's very difficult. You're strapped down very tight.
So you just had to figure out how to work a clutch with your whole leg.
Yeah, I had to teach myself to move way closer to the steering wheel and the pedals.
Yeah.
I moved my seat way closer, and then I could reach the pedal without modifying it.
Since
I lost like 10 inches of range with my ankle being gone.
Right.
So I just moved closer, and now I'm used to it, and I love the seat position.
And are most of the cars that you drive when you do anything clutch cars?
That's a good question. It really depends. Stunt driving is very, sometimes you get a really good car, sometimes you get a really bad car. But most of the time they're automatics.
Yeah.
Especially with these new cars these days, a lot of cars they're getting rid of manuals, which is kind of sad. I would honestly prefer to drive a manual. They're just much more, you can get away with a lot more.
Really? As a stunt driver?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Why?
So, for instance, like if you wanted to do a standing burnout, you get the wheels spinning.
Yeah.
If you're in a manual car, you can use the clutch and just drop the clutch and get it going.
Right, right.
But if you're in an automatic, sometimes you can't even do it because they have...
You got to punch it?
Well, you could sit there and you put your foot on the brake.
Oh, right.
And then you give it full throttle.
Right.
But some of these new cars have sensors where if you're on the brake and the throttle at the same time, it'll kill all power.
Right.
It won't let you do it.
Yeah.
So you have to really work around
these things. Isn't that part of the budget of the fucking movie to where they can fix the car so you can do what you need to do with it?
That would be nice.
Come on. You're just getting like cars off the assembly line?
No. So for Six Underground, all our cars were prepped. Like everything was prepped very, very well, honestly. We went and tested the cars for a few weeks. We told them what we wanted. We had the alpha technicians come out. They worked with us on it, and we had them disable everything that they could to make the cars work what we needed to. And there was some things that they couldn't disable, but we got it working pretty well.
Yeah.
And we were able to do some cool stuff with it. So
when you start doing this, like you could drive fast and you could handle a car, obviously, but, now, was your dad a stunt driver?
No, but he's a good driver. He doesn't specifically do driving.
But he was mostly motorcycles and jumping off things?
That's when he first jumped into the business. He was in motorcycles, and he would crash motorcycles, jump them, do all. He was the motorcycle guy, and then he was learning other things, and then he was, you know, just turned into a well-rounded stuntman.
You have an uncle who's doing it now, too, as well, Brian, right?
Yes.
What's his specialty?
Right now, it's directing.
But before he
would do everything. I mean, he was just there. So the Smurfs brothers, Greg and Brian, they were very good at rigging. So by that, I mean, if you see like superheroes flying through the air and they're on wires, they're very, very, very smart, and they can look at that situation and figure out what to do.
Okay.
And that's what they did. Like my dad did it on Ghost Protocol with Tom Cruise on the Burj Khalifa.
Yeah.
They had to have all these cables and cranes, and it was wild. I mean, it was.
How do you get a crane a half mile up?
They had truss inside, and they had all these. I don't know very much about the rigging and stuff, but there was all kinds of safety
almost
precautions
like,
and everything.
You have to
wild.
Be like almost like an engineer.
Yes.
All right. So here you are. You've got the leg issue. You're coming out of racing. Your dad's one of the most successful dad and uncle stunt guys in Hollywood. And you're like, I want to do stunts. How does that start? How do you get your start?
So I was very fortunate that my dad was a stunt coordinator at the time when I jumped into it, and he hired me onto a movie called The Surrogates.
Yeah.
It was a Bruce Willis movie, and I worked on it for a couple days, and after like the fifth day, my dad walked up to me, and he pointed to a truck, and he's like, go get in that truck, you're crashing it. And he's like, are you cool with that? I said, yeah. He's like, okay, go get in it. You're setting up to do it.
Yeah.
So he's like, I'll have Russell help you get your belt sorted, and you're going to go in about 20 minutes.
The seatbelt.
Seatbelt. So you put like these special, you don't wear the regular seatbelt. You put like racing harness.
So this is a big opportunity. What were you doing on the set before that? Just driving?
Just driving. It was called nondescript driving, ND driving. So I was doing some of that, watching other people do cool stuff. And then
did you know how to like spin a car out and all that other shit?
Well, so I was a good driver
right.
as far as racing and stuff right. and driving quickly, but as far as stunt driving, no, I was very new, and it's very different. And I thought that I was a good driver, a good stunt driver, but I wasn't. And I would go in and I would try something, and it was, you know, it would be scary. I could do it, but it was very out of control.
So
now it's to the point I've learned that stuff and I can do both, but when you get off the racing circuit, you think you're really good.
Right, right, of course. So when your dad says you're going to crash a truck, you didn't know really how to crash a truck.
No, but he, but there was some very talented, you know, stunt drivers and stuff on set. They gave me some pointers.
How do you crash a truck?
So when I only had a lap belt in for this one. So when I was going into it, I kind of braced my arms.
Big truck?
It was a Chevy Avalanche.
Okay.
So I braced my arms on the steering wheel so I had something to, you know, push off. And then I tucked my chin to my chest.
Yeah.
And it helps with the whiplash once you actually hit the car.
Yeah.
So if you're ever going to get into a car accident that you know you're going to crash, duck your chin. It helps.
Yeah. Okay.
And yeah, but the thing was with this one was it was a blind intersection, so we couldn't see each other. We were behind each other like buildings.
Yeah.
So we had to have someone do a countdown of 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, bam.
Yeah.
So, and we had radios and we were listening to that while we were driving up. So it was just one of those things with racing. I had good timing, so that helped.
Yeah.
But as far as hitting it, something like that, doing a T-bone, it just kind of takes balls. You just kind of got to man up and do it.
Yeah.
So I think that was the test. He threw
you
me
into
it.
You were getting T-boned or you were T-boning?
I was T-boning.
Yeah.
Which was very, which was good. Better.
Yeah.
So that was good. I ended up doing very well. Did it 3 times. They messed up on one of the shots with the effects.
Is that
the
3 different trucks?
Let's see. I think I went through 2 trucks.
Okay.
The second angle, they were looking differently. They were able to do it twice.
Now, when like, that was the thing I talked about, Shauna. She really had to learn or teach herself how to be fearless. I mean, is that something you had to reckon with?
I think racing helped a lot.
Oh, right.
with the fearlessness.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's fearlessness or stupidity.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Like the racing I was doing was very serious. There was a lot of very competitive drivers when I was racing. Mm-hmm. And they're all racing IndyCar and everything right now. They're killing it. They're winning everything. So I was racing very fast company.
Yeah.
And we were all very aggressive racing. So as far as driving quickly and being around things that are moving very tight spaces, I was used to that.
Right.
But as far as fearlessness, like crashing a car is completely different.
Yeah.
I don't really think about the crash at all. Personally, I feel like I've lived a pretty cool, good life and stuff. So if something happens, it happens.
Yeah.
But we take all the safety precautions and I don't really think about that. What I'm thinking about, what's going through my brain when I'm about to do it is, where am I going to hit my mark? You know, what's the timing? I don't think about the crash at all.
Right.
I just think about where I need to go, where I need to hit my mark, and it all works out.
The requests that happen, that I guess the common requests for or direction, so you can crash cars, you can roll cars, you can, you know, do the peeling out business, you can spin them around, you can weave, and like when someone says you got to roll a car, how do you do that?
So there's a few ways. There's these new pneumatic arms that they're using. They're electronic arms.
Oh,
and
they just pump you right up.
Yeah, so they have these. It's like a battery or what. I don't know how they operate, but there's like an arm underneath the car,
yeah.
And you'll press a button and it goes out and then it retracts immediately. So it'll flip the car, but it'll disappear when on camera. You won't even see it.
Oh, right.
So they have these pneumatic arms. The old school way, which they still do it, is a cannon roll. So they actually have a bomb sitting next to you, and you'll press the button and it'll blow this pipe into the ground, and that pipe is completely loose and it'll fly wherever it goes.
Right.
But that's what gets you up and flips you over.
Okay.
I haven't done one of those personally. I've only done the pneumatic arms. It's kind of the new way that they're going about doing things now. But that's how you do it. And you just have this button and you got to time it right and flip at the right time. If you hit the button at the wrong time, you'll flip over and it won't look good.
You'll flip
in a straight line and you have to hit it at like a 45 degree angle. You hit the e-brake and you slide the car and you get to a specific angle and you hit the button. And then it makes it
so flip. You just feel the angle.
Exactly.
Now, what's to stop the cab from crushing? You know, like,
so we have roll cages in there.
Oh, okay, right.
And we'll have, hopefully it's a good roll cage. Usually I'll always go in and inspect it and look at the cage, see how the welds are and everything. And I have never personally seen a cage break.
Yeah.
I've heard stories and stuff. So
yeah.
I'm very, very precautious of those when I look at them. Sometimes I've seen a few cages and I'm like, eesh. I don't know if I want to do anything in that.
But that happens. So what? Whose fault is that? I mean, how do you determine that?
So this one I'm talking about in particular, we were in India.
Yeah.
So they didn't. didn't have really any specialists as far as welders and stuff. It was kind of very
low budget,
cheap, low budget
movie.
Movie, and, yeah. But it was, you know, it's India. It's kind of so it everything an, goes over there.
But right, but it was an Indian production, wasn't an American film shooting in India.
It was. It was an American film shooting in India.
Huh. And you would think so. The same rules don't apply because you're in India.
Yeah, it's just it's a funny business. You know, there's they try and crazy. Save money as best they can sometimes, and that's you know they don't think about.
But
it.
But you didn't get in it.
Well, no, this was not for me. It was for someone else who was doing the stunt. I was just looking at it. I was like, man, yeesh.
Did you say that to the guy?
Yeah, he knew. He was like, yeah, I know, man.
But he did it?
It's just the stuntman's mentality sometimes. You see it and you're like, well, I'm here. We're doing it. So
that's a little crazy, right? It's just the way it is?
It is, yeah.
Now, when you drive cars off of things, how do you control? Like, I know this is just practical stuff, but I mean, so like, what have you had to do? In what's the most risky thing you had to do with driving a car off of a thing?
Off, like, do you say like off of a ramp
cliff,
or something,
cliff or a building or whatever? Like, you know,
I haven't.
When a car is airborne, falling.
Yeah, I haven't had to do that yet.
Oh, you haven't.
I've done car jumps.
Yeah, car jumps.
Like 3 foot ramps or something.
Oh, okay.
And that's pretty fun. You just it's like you have your mark and you just make sure you hit your mark and
because
you hit
there's
the right
nothing
speed.
You, once you're do like it's the same with the roll. Once you cut that angle and you hit that thing, you don't have any control over it.
Right.
You can't. There's nothing you can do in the car to make it go a certain way.
Totally. And the thing with jumps too that you have to be worried about is you can jump the car and the suspension could break. And what if that happens? I've heard stories of that where the front wheel's just completely pancaked and the guy's completely out of control, can't do anything about it. And he's just along for the ride at that point.
Yeah.
And so usually for stuff like that, we'll have catch cars with stunt people in them. So if the car is out of control, they'll try and crash into him to stop him from hitting camera people or buildings or stuff like that. So
they're all just there on set.
Just safety precautions, you know, and we'll have stunt people, you know, with the cameramen. So if something happens and they're focused on the camera, they'll yank them out of the way, stuff like that. So
do you, when you, is your idea, when you think about what you do, because I mean, on some level, it's obviously life, like death defying stuff. And, you know, there is an idea that there is a possibility that you could die if there's an accident. Obviously, it's happened in your family, and it's happened to you to a certain degree. Neither one of those events were on camera. But, I mean, do you ever consider that, well, I'm doing this, I'm putting my life on the line to entertain people? Or are you just so consumed in the task at hand that really isn't part of it? It's just there's a stunt person, man, like kind of disposition where it's the stunt itself. It's not like, you know, like I could die trying to get this silly shot for this opening sequence.
Yeah. So I don't honestly, I don't think about it as far as like an entertainment standpoint. I really enjoy it. I love crashing cars. I love drifting and driving and all that stuff. And I think it's cool to be able to like go to Florence and drift a car in the streets. Like it's just super
drifting,
cool.
That means like just like when it's
sliding a car and just you're crashing in the streets of Italy. It's just rad. It's super cool.
But like every one of those pieces, just you driving around that fountain with the other cars chasing you, that's a whole day, right?
Working with Michael Bay, he'll have like 15 setups. So that was literally, we would be there for 30 minutes, get that shot, and then move on to another location and do it all over another shot.
He goes that quick?
Very fast. Moves very, very quickly. He does not mess around. He knows exactly what he wants, and he wants it done now. Like, you know, he's very serious, and if he gets it done, he's a super happy camper. So.
Were there any accidents that were unplanned?
There was no accidents that were like accidental. We did not wreck any alphas on accident, which was great. So
yeah.
Very thankful for that.
There seemed to be an awful, like I have to watch the rest of the movie, but there was a lot of cars after you guys. I mean, it seemed like the entire country was after you.
There was a lot of cars. There was. And they didn't even show them all. There was 7 cars chasing me when we were doing the Italy scene. It was, you can see them, but like for most of the chase, I had like 7 other stunt guys chasing me 2 feet behind me. It was pretty cool.
And
like,
were the Italians generally excited about it?
They were so stoked. They were so happy we were there.
Is the Alfa an Italian car?
It is, yes.
Oh, so I imagine it works as somewhat of an ad for Alfa.
Yes. Which I honestly didn't even think about it until I saw some of the shots, and I'm like, man, like the shot drifting around the fountain with the with the Duomo in the background, I thought was cool. Like,
yeah.
And that's perfect for a
Who was
a commercial.
The guy who was jumping down the Duomo?
Man, what was his name? He was a free runner.
So he's sort of a stunt guy, the actor is?
He was not a stunt guy. He was, well, so the actor did.
What's a free runner?
He'll go out and do flips around walls and over railings, and he'll do like these crazy flips and tricks.
Stunt guy that had to run down the dome there.
Yes, but he wasn't actually a stunt guy. He was they hired a free runner, and he was willing to do it because that's what he does.
Right,
it's heights and stuff, so we got him his SAG card, and that's how he got into it. So, he wasn't a stunt guy per se.
Right. But he knew how to do that.
He was the guy for the job.
But he had ropes on, right?
Yes. Honestly, from what I heard, I wasn't there for a lot of the stuff, but I'm friends with the people that were rigging for them and making them safe.
Yeah.
And they didn't want ropes most of the time. They wanted to do it free solo because they thought the ropes were going to get in their way.
Yeah.
But once they learned and they were told, like, hey, these ropes aren't going to be in your way, and you can do anything you can think of because you're not going to die.
Right.
You know? And that got them like, oh, okay. Like,
right.
We'll do it. Loved it. And they were like, then they were doing some stupid cool stuff. I don't know if you saw it at all, but once you get deeper in the movie, they're doing some pretty great. Like, the free runners, they were on it. I thought they killed it in the movie.
Well, I mean, it's a weird sort of thing, but it seems like a lot of these extreme athletics that people enjoy or that people come up doing, you know, kind of sets them up for a career like this.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like the more of these kind of movies they make, whether you like them or not, there's like plenty of work for people that are willing to do this shit.
Absolutely. And that's what I was getting at before, is it's kind of turning into a business of specialties. So like my specialty is driving.
Yeah.
If they need a skydiving sequence and they don't have a guy that looks like the actor or whatever, they could go find someone that's a pro skydiver and bring him in and give him a SAG card, and then bam, he's in the business.
There you
know?
Go.
It's a pretty open business right now, but it's kind of turning into like a talent-based, you know, like what's your talent?
Well, specific, you know. Right. So now with driving, a couple questions. What happens to all, do they use the parts? I mean, like, it seems like you got a lot of pieces of cars everywhere. I mean, now did someone come along and, you know, kind of repurpose that shit?
Like parts that break off or whatever?
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, engines and all this other shit. I mean, where does all that stuff go? I know it's not in your pay, it's not in your purview or whatever, but what happens to all the cars?
So from what I understand, I don't know 100%, but I think most of those cars, they get crushed. They can't sell them legally.
Right.
So I think they just get crushed, or they'll get brought for like show cars. For, you know,
but
like
you would
a Netflix,
think that
you know,
some crazy, like, you know, car guys would just pull the parts out, you know, the engine parts and whatever.
I wish. I don't think he can.
Oh, really? It's a legal thing.
I think these cars were given by Alpha, it was more of like a here you go. It's like a legal thing. They can't legally take the stuff and use it kind of
right
cool.
And in terms of back to the sort of manual stick versus automatic, because I learned how to drive on a stick because I wanted to know how to drive on the stick. Now, like, do you in general, why do people prefer, like, is it a better car, like a manual car?
So my personal opinion of it, I love driving a stick shift for the fact that I feel more in tune with the car.
Right,
it's you're using it, you're shifting the gears,
right,
you have
more control
of everything,
right.
That's why I like it, and I really like. There's a few other reasons, like they're small reasons, but like if everyone drove a stick shift, there'd be way less texting and driving. You can't. It's way harder to text when you're driving a stick shift.
Are they still doing it in Europe? Are most of the cars?
Oh yeah, I don't think that'll ever change. Europeans love stick shifts. They don't want anything to do with automatics.
It's just the way it is.
Yeah.
And in terms of, like, what car do you drive normally?
My daily is a 1991 BMW M5. And
right,
that's
BMW.
Yeah, they only make those in stick. So that's, and most of my cars are stick. I have a few, like, I drove my truck today. That's automatic. But it really depends. Like, for me, personally, if my leg's not feeling great, I'll just drive my automatic.
Right.
And, you know, but that's mostly what I go
on. So you don't have, do you have any old American sticks?
I don't. No, I'm a BMW fanatic. I collect old 1980s and 90s BMWs.
You like Beamers, huh?
Mm-hmm.
They're just good cars?
They just handle so well.
Really?
The thing is they're very high maintenance and they break a lot.
Yeah.
But they drive, when they're working, they drive fantastic. They're
really?
Such good cars. Yeah.
Better than anything else you've ever driven.
So here's the thing.
Yeah.
After driving on 6-cylinder ground in that Alpha, the Giulia, it handled very much like an M3, and I really, really like that car. I would honestly buy one. But I would want the one that we had in the movie that had all the electronics, everything turned off.
Right.
So, but that car was amazing. When we had it dialed, that car was solid.
Did you see that Ford Ferrari movie?
I did. I actually worked on it.
You did?
Mm-hmm.
So what'd you do on that one?
I drove a 1957, like, Porsche Speedster. It was pretty cool. So I drove one of those, and then I drove one of the red Ferraris in the scene where you're running to the cars when the start of the Le Mans.
Yeah.
So I ran to the car, jumped in, and drove out. So that was cool.
How'd the Ferraris drive?
So I was fortunately in one of the best cars on set. Yeah. I was in one of the Ferraris that had the LS3 motor, and it had like 550 horsepower. That thing was wicked.
Yeah.
Some of them were like show cars, like they didn't have good engines or whatever, just for to look good. But that one was fast, and I was pretty stoked to be in that for the day.
So that must have been fun to do a period piece with the old cars.
To be honest with you, that was one of the coolest days on set because just it felt like the set looked so real.
Yeah.
And if you just focused on that one spot and didn't look around you, it felt like you were actually at the 24-hour Le Mans. It was pretty cool.
And those cars, like, people are freaks for the old, you know, cars. I don't know much about them, but those Shelbys, you know, people love those things.
Absolutely.
I guess there's not that many around.
No, they're rare. Very
but you
rare.
Don't, but you're not a car freak. You just like your Beamers and that's it.
Yeah, I'm not like specifically, I don't know a lot about cars.
Yeah.
Just like the cars that I like, I'll learn about them and BMWs are my favorites. So.
Well, that's good to know because they like, what about electric cars? Anything?
So I just drove a Porsche Taycan,
yeah.
And that's the new Porsche electric car, and that thing is wicked.
Really?
It is really cool. It's all-wheel drive, electronic. It's got like 700 horsepower. It's got like 600 foot-pounds of torque, and it is fast.
Really?
Oh, man. Yeah. I was blown away.
Where'd you drive that?
At the Porsche Test Center.
Oh, yeah. Do they hire you to do that stuff?
That was actually a test for an upcoming movie that we're going to be doing. I can't say much about it, but it was a fun day. Yeah, I just got to go out and drive it and have fun with that thing. So.
Because now, like when something like that, not to name the movie, but is that the production company wants to use that? They're in talks with Porsche to use that car. So, and then you got to go try it?
Yeah, and that's the thing. We just need to make sure it works and if we can actually do stuff. And if not, then we'll work around it. And that's the same thing we do with Alpha with Six Underground.
Right. So, when you go test it, do you spin it out and, you know, whatever? What's the thing where it just moves on the side?
Yep. Yeah. So, we were just in an empty skid pad and just throwing it around, see what it can do, see how the electronics limit you, stuff like that. So,
and that's all day?
Yep. I mean, it was probably a couple hours long.
That's fun, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And what for you, what were some of the high points in terms of, the best rides you've had in films? Like the most, like I know that Six Underground, that looked like it was something, like to be in Italy doing that. But what are some of the other ones that you did that were like, fuck?
Let's see. I did a pipe ramp for Fear the Walking Dead, the TV show.
Yeah.
And that was a pretty gnarly one. I was going probably 58 miles an hour. I was in a pickup truck, like a little two-door Dodge Ram.
Yeah.
And the pipe ramp was... It had a stop, like an 8-inch stopper on the top of it, so it was supposed to. I was supposed to hit it and completely stop, and then like it was supposed to look like I hit a tree.
Oh, okay.
It was butted up against a palm tree.
Yeah,
and I was pretty nervous about that one, but I didn't. Like I said, I didn't think about the crash or anything. I was just trying to hit my mark. But that was my first pipe ramp.
Which a pipe ramp is what exactly?
It's when you have this metal pipe that's like sticking up like 6 feet into the air, and you just drive up it and flip. So, and that's, you just got to hit it and flip. And, the thing with pipe ramps is they're kind of unpredictable.
Yeah.
Whereas a cannon, you kind of expect what's going to happen. Pipe ramps, anything can happen. You have no idea.
In terms of like whether you roll or just crashed a car?
Yeah. Whether you roll, you could land on your roof. You could land on the driver door, stuff like that.
Yeah,
and that makes a difference from a height because the pipe ramps kind of, sometimes they'll get you pretty high.
Yeah.
I've seen cars like 15 feet high and they'll land, you know, it depends how they land, but sometimes that can ring you pretty good.
The illusion is you're out of control and the car is going to hit a tree.
Exactly. So that thing was, it was on a stopper up to a palm tree and I came in and I hit it and I did, I think 2.5 rolls and I landed on the driver door and I bruised my ribs on that one. So that was one of the few times I've gotten injured doing a stunt, but
how'd it look?
It looked cool. Yeah. I can show you later.
And so, yeah, you're always busy.
I try to be. Yeah, no, it's been pretty busy for the last 6 months. I've been all over the place and very thankful. And
but outside of the bruised ribs, no injuries.
Outside of bruised ribs, no injuries. Nope. I've on Six Underground, I jammed my thumb doing one of the crashes, but I was healed in about 2 weeks or
and
so.
That was it. So that's
nothing serious.
Well, everything's going good then. And now I imagine your dad's proud of you.
I think he did. I think so. So he basically.
We always have something to talk about.
Yeah, yeah. He threw me into the business and he opened the doors for me and he kind of shoved me through the doors and said, if you want to make it, it's all on you.
Yeah.
So I think he's pretty happy that I've made it as far as I have. He hires me and I work for him. Like I worked for him on Six Underground. He was the coordinator for that one. But I don't work with him too often. Most of my stuff I've tried to get on my own. And so I think he's proud about that.
On purpose, you don't work for him too often?
No, I think it was more on purpose from him. Like, yeah. He wants me to make it on my own. You know, he didn't want me to, you know, be...
Right, be seen as the guy.
Right.
So, but you guys get along on set? Is there any...
Oh, yeah,
no,
always.
There's no father-son dynamic? Like, what are you doing?
I mean, sometimes there is, you know. but I usually... He's pretty knowledgeable, and he's been around a lot longer than I have. So I usually try and bite my tongue and...
and take it?
Probably right, so... Yeah.
Well, good talking to you, man.
Absolutely, yeah. Thank you very much.
Yeah. So that was Brett Smeres. You can watch any of the movies we talked about. But the Michael Bay film, Six Underground, is out. You can watch that on Netflix. And don't forget, with Simply Safe Home Security, you get comprehensive protection for your home. Simply Safe uses real video evidence to give police an eyewitness account of any break-ins. And it's all monitored 24/7 by live security professionals. Go to simplysafe.com/WTF today and get a free Simply Safe security camera. Normally $100. Go today and it's free. That's simplysafe.com/WTF. Soon I will get the guitars out here. Boomer lives.